This is side B of the second cassette in the Joe Herzenberg interview.
I particularly attacked the university's land use and thoroughfare plan because that clearly was what was making people angry at the time. I mean, there was a meeting, I didn't go to it, but there was a meeting in that large lecture hall on the ground floor of Hamilton, which was packed with people who were, this was the university trying to explain what it was doing, and people who weren't really interested in hearing any explanation, they were so angry. So I think that was, there are all these relatively small issues, you know, a couple of dozen at least, but the big issue was that the neighborhood revolt now was taking place in the older precincts.
Who, if you had to sketch a picture of who it is in Chapel Hill in local politics who really, you know, can exercise some clout, who is it and how do they do it?
That's very hard to answer. I've been thinking of that myself. I've been writing some fundraising letters for people who are running this year, and I wonder whether, even in that very narrow sense, that works, whether people who supported me will support somebody else just because I said. I think Chapel Hill is very fragmented, and there have been organizations. The Neighborhood Alliance is the best example. Grassroots groups that bring people together, and that their endorsement, especially in that crucial 85 election, was worth a great deal. But frankly, even though some people think the opposite, they think that some group, the Chamber of Commerce, the university, the Neighborhood Alliance, has clout and can pull strings and help candidates. That is not really my my impression. I was really surprised to see the wife of a middle-level administrator, an associate vice chancellor, something like that. And she was identified. That was how she was identified, as the wife of this person. I mean, I don't know her, so I don't know whether she exists other than in terms of who her spouse is. But she was endorsing a candidate for office. That the university has traditionally avoided doing that. There are exceptions, of course, when the wife of some of a Don Bolton's wife was on the. Of course, he supported his wife, but you don't find other vice chancellors publicly saying they endorsed Marilyn Bolton. I think that's pretty unusual. And in a town where a very common campaign device is an endorsement ad, where you try to get lots, and I once had 600 names, including my cat, its name, on an endorsement ad. That's a lot of work. But you'll notice that there are very few university administrators, very few prominent leaders in the Chamber of Commerce. They're scared to sign something like that. There's a very much a politics of gentility or civility in this town, and something that is not widely understood, even a few miles away in Durham, the political spectrum is not very broad, so that in Durham, where they have real fights and where there is clearly a conservative group and a liberal group and one or two people in between, that in Chapel Hill, everybody is in between, so that the independent has a hell of a time trying to figure out who endorse, because everybody seems to be the same. And the nuances are what are so important. And this is happening in Carborough now, too. Carborough used to be more ideologically bifurcated than Chapel Hill, but it's following Carborough's lead. So, and you even now have the case where in the last mayoral election 4 years ago, Ken Brown was clearly the liberal candidate. Even the independent could figure that out. And Rosemary Waldorf was the more conservative candidate. Now, she wasn't very conservative, but she was somewhat more conservative. Now, Ken is going to endorse Rosemary for mayor, and nobody's running against her. I mean, it's sort of like the 50s. A consensus has arrived in Chapel Hill. I mean, and see, you have something like domestic partners legislation. Now, admittedly, we had a nice little lobbying effort, and especially in Carrboro, but even in Chapel Hill, a lesbian couple, 17 years together, two kids, called the two or three members of council who were considered problematic, and just talked about what it's like to be a domestic partner. But the vote was unanimous. There were a couple of probing questions asked by council members, which is, we still permit people to question things even if it's obvious they should vote the right way. And then, what happened was one of the more conservative members of the council, again within this narrow framework, said, the way I figure it, it's only the fair thing to do. And this matter of whether we're going to let them have benefits, that too, how can you deny it? It's just the fair thing to do. So it passes 9-0. So there.
What's it like to be someone who the press is for many years would consistently, it would always be Joe Hertzberg, comma, the only openly gay elected official south of the Mason-Dixon line, comma?
Well, for me, for somebody who has a sense of history, who was trained more or less to be a historian, what you have to admit that's pleasing sometimes. It's not always pleasing, but see, it segues into being a fairly visible elected official, period. I mean, if you eat in certain places, no, I'm not talking about eating in a fancy restaurant, but if you eat at, let's say, Penguins at Wellspring, people have no hesitation to come to you, up to you in the middle of your velvety tomato soup and ask you your opinion on some land use question. I mean, they just think that you belong to them. And there's been a little relief of that, which I've been grateful for since I left the council. I mean, because in many ways I am a fairly private person. And to have people, I think they really think they own you. And, of course, telephone answering machines have been great contributions to dealing with that problem. But, and frankly, most people are wonderful. There is not any problem. I don't mean to say I ever got too many calls or too many letters or too many references in the newspaper. But there is a small number of difficult people who predominate and life would have been, at least a quantum leap better if they had moved somewhere else. They're the people who, they read, they're moved by the slightest matter to call you and to disagree with, it's not even disagreeing with you, it's just talking with you.
Has that status brought you any interesting, I'm sure it has, many interesting connections to gay officials and gay elected officials across the country?
Yes, there's an organization, of course. Every group has its organization and its convention. And I knew of it. It was organized when the city of West Hollywood, conceivably the only jurisdiction, whole city, that it may have a gay majority, when they were organized in 85, they had, as soon as their elected officials were sworn in, they called a conference of all the openly gay officials, who were about 20 then. And of course you could go to the conference anyway, even if you weren't, or if you're thinking of running, or you had been. But I was kind of superstitious and didn't go until I was elected in 87. So I missed the first two. But I went to the next several one and got to know most of those people, really, by and large, a very interesting group of politicians. I mean, I think that, I can't say all politicians, but lots of politicians are really very interesting and interesting to know. And these were an exceptional group. Again, there are always a couple of rotten apples in any barrel, but by and large, I was just overawed. And so I'd read about most of these people, because it was such a small group to start with. I think the first year I went, 87, to Minneapolis, there were about 25 or 30. It's, even now, it's only up to about 100. But I went to the subsequent meetings in Minneapolis, San Diego, Madison, Boston, and Houston. And then we had the meeting here in Chapel Hill. And in 92, the meeting was held here. And by then, I think we had about 75 or 80 people come. I was a little nervous about them coming to a small town. Actually, West Hollywood is smaller than Chapel Hill, but it's in the middle of Los Angeles. But, you know, they'd been to Madison was the smallest place they'd met, and I was afraid they would be unhappy about the limited opportunities for late-night reveling. But they had a great time in Chapel Hill. And the people at the Caroline Inn were just wonderful, where we met the mayors of Carrboro and Chapel Hill both spoke at it, and they had good food and good shopping, and some of them have even come back to visit. By now, there's been just enough incremental increase, and in California, where it was the biggest state as far as Gaelic officials were concerned, term limits has abruptly ended the careers of all the old-timers, who were a very distinguished group of people, both in their own communities and within the Democratic parties in their states, for example.
I'd like to ask you questions about the rise of the Republican Party, and it will implicate some of these cultural issues as the politics has played out. At root, how would you characterize the realignment? How do you explain what's come to pass in the last, maybe you could pick the 84 legislative election here in North Carolina as the first mark of finally getting a few Republicans over there in the legislature, and things are beginning to start to Martin's elected that year, obviously.
Yes. Well, it does seem to me that Lyndon Johnson was right, I think. And how we could have avoided that, how he, you know, let's say he were younger and were still alive and were pulling the strings as a grand puppeteer, I don't know what you could do about that. I do think, and I'm sad that this is the case, that hostile racial views are still the single most important factor. Beyond that, I'm not sure what to say. And it's not just that. And there is clearly a backlash against women as well, but I think that is still far less significant than the racial backlash. And you can see it all over, even here in Chapel Hill. It's relatively minor. And they did defeat Bill Thorpe and me in 81, but that housing project was built. And but of course, it's hard to... You can only use the local scene as the extreme in these things.
Is your sense that these are trends that are likely to continue?
I don't know. You know.
And what do you think it means for gay politics?
Well, there are two very divergent things you can see happening, getting worse or getting better, The getting better part of it is that it is increasingly clear that there are a lot of gay Republicans. And, of course, they've always been there. It's just that they're more outspoken now than they used to be. And how much they are able to work within their party and resist the religious right, you know, it's just a guess. There's been in North Carolina, there's been very little evidence of any so-called log cabin movement in the Republican Party. And what gay Republicans I'm aware of in this state are pretty closeted. And I think, you know, I know a few really wealthy gay Republicans who are less likely to give money, but that's about it. And so that doesn't really have much dent on Republican things. I think that North Carolina, and one problem in North Carolina vis-a-vis other states, is we do not have one large urban center. If you could combine the populations of the four or five largest cities, and we had one such large city, I would guess, for example, that gay Republicans are a far more significant factor in Atlanta. I don't know the scene there, but I would just guess there's more going on with gay Republicans than in all of North Carolina. And that's certainly true in California and New York or in Massachusetts, where conceivably Well is the most gay-friendly governor in the country, certainly one of the most. I don't know all the governors. So I know that his election, and of course he beat a conservative Democrat who was awful on gay rights, so in the same sense that we talked about earlier, gay voters may have given William Weld the margin of victory. So, but how, I have the sense that there will not be a repeat of Houston? Yes, the Houston convention, where there was openly anti-gay rhetoric. Despite Buchanan and his that group of right-wing candidates that they have, I think that it's maybe just difficult enough an issue, and there may be just enough prominent Republicans with gay connections. Like, you know of Mosbacher, mm-hmm. who was Commerce Secretary for Bush, and whose lesbian daughter, she's a filmmaker in Southern California, and she was nominated for an Oscar for some movie she made. And I just saw a picture of her father and she in the gay newspaper last week. And I don't know how active he is in Republican politics, but one could guess that he wouldn't tolerate that sort of thing at any meeting he was at.
Because he's supportive relationship with his daughter.
With his daughter, yes. He's always, as far as I know, he's always been very good with his daughter.
Share your recollections or views on a few of these issues have played out in North Carolina politics. Do you remember the ERA struggle?
Yes, although I was marginally involved in that. You know, the problem with being from Orange County in a case like that is there's no point in going to Raleigh and lobbying with your legislatures because our legislators are already supportive. I mean, I did go to a couple of ERA things in Raleigh, but mainly it went to fundraisers here. And I have not read the Matthews book, so I don't know what they conclude went wrong. I mean, I know at the time there was some sentiment that Jim Hunt hadn't gone as far as he ought to have gone with that, considering how many of those people, those women in particular, were close to him.
How about the role of the religious right in North Carolina politics?
Well, there's no doubt that even before the debacle of last year, they were a force to be reckoned with. And again, I didn't personally witness this, but I'm not quite sure when it was. It was sometime in the middle 80s when a legislative committee took up the repeal of the sodomy law, you know, and they just bussed in people in church-owned buses and made a loud noise. And that was quite a while ago, before they became what they are now, I think.
Let's take a break if we could for just a minute. All right, Joe, a couple things for the remaining portion of our conversation, as we were talking there in the break. I wanted to ask about, to begin, let's go back and look at a few of these other things you mentioned that are important landmarks in the evolution of gay political activity here in North Carolina. You mentioned the Gay Pride March in Durham in 86, which was the first, and you mentioned Whip Gully and so forth. So that would be an excellent place to start here.
Well, I think it's an interesting case study in the whole late spring and summer, early fall of 86 in Durham. Durham has a very active gay and lesbian community, especially lesbian community. I think that Chapel Hill and Carborough even suffer because of the higher cost of housing here, and a lot of women who might live here can't afford to and end up living in Durham. And I think that over the years, as I've watched it, they have they have one of the largest lesbian-owned businesses in the country in Lady Slipper Records. And, it's a great group of people over there, and sometimes I envy them. But for reasons of it, which I can't really recall, I just think a number of activists in the spring of 86 decided that other places all over the country had gay pride marches, why don't we? And also, there was some sense that the gay and lesbian community had supported all kinds of other progressive movements, and maybe it was time for people in those movements to support us. So with that in mind, they went to Mayor Whip Gully, who was probably the most progressive mayor Durham had had since Durham was created, and asked him if he would issue a gay and lesbian rights proclamation, the kind of thing that mayors do every day. He did. Actually, even Webb watered it down to, I think it was called a civil rights ordinance in the end, and gay and lesbian weren't in the title of the ordinance, although they were in the text. And then
proclamation.
Did I say ordinance? Proclamation. Yeah, you know, they issue Pickle Week proclamations, and not to make fun of them, but they're a dime a dozen, and they aren't worth the very expensive paper they're often embossed on or printed on. But as soon as he did this, there was quite a flare-up among, and it was an interesting group because it was white conservative Republicans and black conservative Christians. It was an interesting group of people. I should point out, at the same time, we asked the chair of our county commission, I think we thought the mayor wouldn't do it. In any case, we asked the chair of our county commission, Don Wilhoy, who issued an identical proclamation, and they did have a bunch of conservative clergy and members of conservative Christian churches who went to one meeting of the county commissioners, but that was all. It was, you know, it was one scene, whereas in Durham, this continued for a whole season. The march went off very well. I was one of the few men who worked on that project because it was mainly Durham lesbians who got it together. It was small, but it was very nice. People had a great time. And we were back there again this year for the 10th such march, and it's much, much larger, though I don't really think it was as large as the paper said it was. But it was, you know, it was even more joyous. For one thing, it wasn't as hot. It's usually very hot on the days of these.
When was the first helping of the day?
No, it would have been late June of 86. The North Carolina ones have always been held in June, although it's moved a little earlier in time. They've moved around.
Charlotte.
That's right. The notion originally was that they would always be in Durham for no other reason than that the first one had been there. But it began to be a movable celebration. It went to Raleigh, and then in recent years it's alternated between Raleigh, or at least the Triangle, and some other place. And it's been in Charlotte and Asheville, and next year is going to be in Winston-Salem for the first time.
Has the effort to organize that also broadened with the geographical?
Yes, yes. And it really has been so successful that it's become a very profitable endeavor. That is, the first year we had trouble coming up with a couple thousand dollars we needed, mainly for equipment. Now they have a printed program. People buy ads, people make donations, and they have $12,000 left over that they have to argue about what to do with. So it's really become... I'm sure that every time it moves to a new place, it's a whole new show, and that's good for the local communities. But in the Triangle, it's sort of become old hat as something new to do. It's been done so often. About half of these, maybe more than half of the 10 have been here. Well, six, I guess. But then after the march was all over, there was a serious effort to recall Whip Gully from office. And they were not able to get enough signatures. But I think the whole experience was just wonderful for the gay community in Durham. One lesbian activist, sort of radical, registered to vote at long last because she wanted to vote against recall if that came up. And there were all kinds of, I don't know what you want to call them, but gay men who were not very out, certainly not out in political activity, who sort of middle-class professionals who got involved in this, who were really threatened by what the conservatives proposed and responded appropriately, in my view. Mm-hmm. And it was really wonderful. I mean, you almost hope that every community will have this kind of experience. And I think in the long run, someone like Anita Bryant, do you know her? Mm-hmm. I think the gay community or gay historians will almost speak fondly of her, because even though in the short run she won and we lost, in the long run she repented at some point. I haven't followed her career. And yes, she did. Well, she had some real personal difficulties. Her husband left her, and some of the things that she was so sure about weren't so sure.
You mean Anita Bryant of
Florida?
Orange Juice Man.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And she led the repeal of the Dade County Ordinance.
I see.
In Florida. And she won in the short run. But she's, I don't mean to say that she's come out for gay rights, but she's much more understanding now. Mm-hmm. And I think it helped vitalize the gay community in South Florida in a way that nothing else mm-hmm. ever did. And I think I don't know a lot of, I don't know anybody in Cincinnati, and I don't know anybody in Colorado either. Not anybody gay anyway. So I don't know, but I suspect that in those states and in Oregon, where there was a referendum on the ballot last year, that those are very extraordinarily helpful organizing events. And there's really never been something like that in Chapel Hill. There have been little tiny ones, but nothing of that scale and scope. So mm-hmm. I do think those things are very important, and I think it's helpful to have these bad guys, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. One question I have, and we haven't focused on this expressly in our conversation, can you describe from the mid-80s forward, the structure of gay political organizations around the state?
Boy, no, because I think some reference to Jell-O would be appropriate. No, structure doesn't seem to be the gay thing. Probably it's genetic, but that's a humorous reference. But even at the national level, it is remarkable how there really only are two big gay organizations left at the national level: the Human Rights Campaign Fund, which is more lobbying and political action committee, and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which is more issue oriented and hate crimes and whatever. They've never been very successful. I mean, they're not failures, but considering what the potential membership or donor base is, if you compare them to other communities, even picking on the African-American community, You know, none of those organizations, or no organization, has ever been, you know, a tiny fraction of what the NAACP, or even what the Inc. Fund has been, which is a very small organization. So at the statewide or even the local level within the state, organizations haven't been a great success. I mean, this now, if you look in gay newspapers, you'll still find the Lesbian and Gay Democrats listed. And what I tell people who call the number, which is mine, is that, and in fact, I got a letter just yesterday from somebody in a jail in Oregon who'd read about Helms and wanted to know how he could help educate Helms. I wanted to know which party Helms belonged to. So, you know, somebody who was pretty much out of it, besides being in jail. The Lesbian and Gay Democrats mainly exist to encourage people to try to be a national convention delegate. So we don't do much except for once every 4 years. In the wake of all the excitement in Durham in 86, we organized, because I really had this... I left out one name I should drop. It's not a name you know, but a friend of mine named Paul Melbestad, who was a Moorhead scholar here from Minnesota and came from a sort of left-wing Democratic background in Minnesota, was an undergraduate business and law student here, and then ended up going to San Francisco in the early mid-70s, where he got very active in gay Democratic politics there, and still, three or four times a year, sends me a packet of what's going on with gay politics out there. And I was always really impressed by the model of what became the Harvey Milk, it's now Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Democratic Club, and other groups. And what we tried to do in the Triangle was we created something called the Triangle, either Gay and Lesbian or Lesbian and Gay, I seldom can remember which comes first, Alliance, which was kind of an all-purpose, triangle-wide gay organization, political, social, cultural, and it lasted for about a year before it got bogged down in changes to the bylaws. More recently, Mike Nelson, there only are two state, well, this leaves out non-political organizations. You know, there may be a network of metropolitan community churches in North Carolina. There are a half dozen of them. They may have their own little North Carolina organization. But when it comes to political organizations, there are only two. One is called the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Coalition, North Carolina Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality, which was intended originally to be a coalition of organizations, and that never really worked out very well. And it really is very weak, very small, but it still exists, and it has a full-time paid employee. So I think that's remarkable. Mm-hmm. They work on hate crimes. They're very much like the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force on the national level. But they've lost a lot of board members in recent months, and my impression is they don't have a lot of life beyond their very mild-mannered executive director in Durham. The other is an organization called North Carolina Pride Political Action Committee for Gay and Lesbian Equality. Quite a mouthful. And even though I was marginally active with the coalition when it got going, but I've been very active since it got going with the Pride PAC. Mm-hmm. And we've had some problems. Again, it's with structure. It's with the relationship between the board and the executive director. You know, people who are likely to be executive directors of these organizations are pretty strong people who are may even be willful, and in a bad way even. But they're not likely to be people who are going to sit in the office and wait for the board to call them and tell them what to do. And there are board members who don't really understand that. And so there's been, without going into all the details, we had two really able executive directors, first Mike Nelson, whose idea this largely was, and then Derek Livingston, who was extraordinarily almost charismatic black guy from Sacramento and educated at Brown, one of the four national co-chairs of the last national march in Washington. So really an incredible find for poor little us in North Carolina. But both of them had bad relations with the board and resigned. And now we have just hired M.K. Cullen, a young woman who I think will be as good as both of them. But we've had now for two electoral cycles, 92 and 94, you know, we've done what PACs do. We sent out a questionnaire to everybody running for legislative office. We're a state PAC, so we don't get involved in federal races, but we do get involved in some local races. That is, if a gay candidate were to run, as Mike is about to run for mayor of Carrboro, we'll give him some money. But we did quite well our first year. We didn't get involved until after the primary the first year, but we were surprised how many people, even a few Republicans, returned our forms with the right answers. And we did even better in terms of response in 94. That is, we had I'm not sure what the numbers are, but about twice the number of people responded to the questionnaires, and with an appropriately higher number of good answers. Actually, very few people give bad answers. The ones who respond give good answers. And, you know, in out-of-the-way places and a couple of, you know, it was a half dozen Republicans. We even had a controversy with Leslie Winter because the guy she beat in 2 years ago, not me, or 3 years ago, Ray Warren, was good on gay issues. I sort of knew him when he was a student here. She was great. But he was a Republican. You got to give Republicans a little edge. No, she was wonderful. But I argued. I mean, I don't really know her. I've met her a couple of times. But I argued that we had to be very sensitive to Republicans who were good on our issues. And what we ended up doing was endorsing her because we thought she would be more effective than he was. But we pointed out, especially to our Republican donors, that Ray Warren was good on our issues. We just thought that she'd be better, more effective. And that satisfied me. As the most, on our board, I've been generally the most partisanly Democratic, so I really bend over backwards whenever we find a Republican who's worth anything. And we have a few women, Republican women. But, of course, even though we endorsed more people and gave them more money, both in the primary in the general election, we couldn't do much about the debacle. That is, for one thing, much of the debacle was outside of areas where we had positive response. We have a few rural supporters, but by and large, they're urban people. And of course, we even lost some of our best people in urban areas, particularly in Wake County. But, you know, almost nobody anticipated how awful the Republican sweep would be. Some people had a feel for it, but I think it was very much on a lower scale than what actually happened.
How's gay political activity holding up, or at least these several organizations that are still at work holding up in the new climate?
Well, I think it's a little early to say. I think by and large, we are, I can't say we're succeeding, but we're trying to rise to the challenge. I think, you know how it is, after Reagan was elected, the Sierra Club had a huge boost in membership. It's sort of like that. It's not quite on that scale. But my impression is both in Washington and Raleigh, or locally, that the there are just more and more people who think, you know, we have to fight this, mm-hmm. and people who were complacent beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to touch on that we haven't talked about, I wondered is, has North Carolina had an ACT UP chapter ever?
Yeah, it has one. It's ACT UP Triangle. It is very tiny. I think that they could maybe fit their members very comfortably in this room. My impression is it's really a handful or two of people. And they have been, although they did some very dramatic things at the start, including a siege in the borough's welcome building out in the park, they had a friend who gave them the floor plan, but neglected to point out the thickness of various walls. And they planned to hold up for 4 days. They took enough food for 4 days, and it was right near a highway, so they could hang a banner out the window. And of course, they had somebody who called the police, media, as soon as they got in the building. But they only held out for 4 hours because one of the walls in the room they locked themselves in was a flimsy thing that was very easy to drill through. So, but their main activity has been with regard to maintenance of anonymous testing, mm-hmm. and they have had a very good luck with a legal strategy. They have time and time again, well, maybe a little, they have once or twice succeeded at getting judges to rule their way. And even though I can't quite describe accurately the stage things are in right now, they have some kind of order maintaining anonymous testing for at least another year. And I think it's being sent back to the state Health Services Commission. Some of these things are a little arcane for me. But anyway, it's a state advisory, citizens advisory body, which makes recommendations to the state health officials.
AIDS of late, I mean, has not been so much something that politicians are talking about, at least in the 94 election cycle, so much.
No.
Quieted a bit as an issue.
Well, except for what Helms has been doing with the Ryan White care funds.
That's true.
And all I know about that is it seems to me that and of course, this will be relevant to his own campaign next year, but that Dole has found enough courage to proceed with the matter. That is, despite Helms' efforts to hold it up yesterday in the Senate, and he's offering zillions of little amendments, some of which are very silly, and some are really serious and threatening. But the matter has like 61 sponsors. So it is, what do you need to block a filibuster?
60.
So it's filibuster proof. And I noticed that neither New Jersey Senator, Bradley or Lautenberg, were sponsors of it, which seems to me that means there's 63. So I don't know. It's hard to see where Helms is going with this. It seems to me relatively likely that he'll make it, that he may, see, last time around, or time before that, the gay stuff was not really AIDS specific. But I think that he probably thinks, and he's probably quite right, that he can make a good deal out of the gay AIDS connection. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any friends, he doesn't hate gay people. But some gay people do really disgusting things, and the Congress should not spend money just because these awful gay people are doing awful things.
Mm-hmm. Are there other aspects of gay politics in the state that we haven't discussed that you think we should be sure to?
Well, I think I want to emphasize a couple of points just so they don't get lost in the shuffle. And I think that gay politics is overwhelmingly an urban phenomenon. It had its roots in the years right after the Second World War in places like San Francisco and New York, where there were significant gay populations living in relatively small areas. And that just ain't North Carolina. I mean, even in Chapel Hill, it is hard for me to point out streets that have more than a few gay people living on them. So, and I think from what I know of the demographics of all the cities in the state, there may be a couple of neighborhoods in Charlotte that have more than their portion of gay people, but still, they're not gay ghettos. Nothing like it at all. And those people don't want to live in gay ghettos, and I agree with them. I don't think I'd like to live in a gay ghetto. I'd like to have people in my neighborhood who aren't gay. And so that makes it very difficult when you remember that there is no single large city in this state, and that it's scattered around. To date, activists have succeeded in getting gay-positive legislation passed in Chapel Hill, beginning in 75, in Raleigh, beginning in 88, and in Carrboro, beginning in 91, I think. That is just three cities. There have been efforts in other places. In Durham, where the activists weren't as sophisticated as they should have been, they settled for a council resolution, sort of an advisory resolution, rather than amending an ordinance, which they still may get around to it, but they're just either slow or not sophisticated and don't understand the difference or don't care. In Greensboro, they actually passed an ordinance only to have it voted back a few years later after there was a conservative election. And my understanding is that Greensboro activists just aren't numerous or active enough to push it again. There's also been activity in Charlotte and in Asheville. In Charlotte,